Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Delta Flyers journey through the wormhole with Quark, Dax, and their good friends, Tom and Harry. Join us as we journey through the episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Your hosts along this journey are Terry Farrell, our insightful science officer, Armin Shimmerman, our small business genius, Garrett Wong, our forever ensign, and myself, your favorite helmsman, Robert Duncan McNeil. Today we've got Armin. Hello, Armin.
Hello, 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 hello. Small but genius. I like that. Small but genius.
Our small business genius. Oh, yeah. I meant small business, not a small brain.
Maybe. It's okay. It's all right. Genius. I focused on genius.
Robbie, the way you word it, it does sound like he's a diminutive business genius.
Oh, but that's
you meant small business. Right, as together, and then genius comes afterwards.
Yes. Oh, that's funny.
Well, okay. It's all right. My heart is broken, but it's all right. It's all right.
Well, if he said diminutive, Armin, you could take offense, but diminutive is not in there. So,
no, no.
Okay.
I was thinking more entrepreneurial, like small business owner.
Yes. Right.
But now,
why don't you say entrepreneurial genius? You could say that.
Because I've said that before. I wanted to change it up a little.
I will give it all up for the genius.
Okay.
The genius is the good part.
I know how to read reviews. I know what words to look for.
That's right.
That's good.
That's right. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Let's talk about my recent acting.
Yes, let's talk about that.
We can talk about that.
Let's talk about that. Your trip to Missouri.
Yes, I was in Missouri to film a feature film called 25 Miles to Normal. Josh Brandon is the writer-director, and Josh Brandon is the same individual that was on a tour of our set when he met Robbie McNeil at the tender age of 15, visiting from Australia. And he had that conversation with Robbie saying, look, I love this industry. I want to work in it someday. If I come back, you know, as an adult, would you mentor me? Can I call you? And Robbie goes, sure, yeah, whatever, buddy. And then sure enough, that happened 10 years later.
10 years later,
Robbie,
Robbie's
actually producing Chuck at the time. His assistant calls him and says, yeah, there's a Josh Brandon said that you told him to call you. He left a message. Robbie goes online, types, thinking that this is another exec in the industry. He types his name into Google. He's like, there's nothing. He's like, I don't know who this is.
Who is this guy?
Yeah.
Continue the story.
What happens then?
Yeah. So I felt like, well, if somebody's calling saying, I said, call me, I must have said it to someone. So I was like, sure, set up a lunch, you know, have him come down to Warner Brothers, you know, or a meeting. Yeah. So he comes over and then he tells me this story.
Yeah.
And he tells me the whole thing. And I had vague memories. I was like, maybe, because we had a lot of tours come through. You know what I mean?
So, right. And it wasn't a normal Paramount tour, Robbie. You're wrong about that. Like, his family or someone there knew somebody. They knew somebody that worked in the production. So he had a VIP tour. That's why he was on the set. Yeah.
Well, we had our little meeting, and then he said, I've written a couple of, you know, spec scripts. I've got some samples. He had a writing partner at the time. And he said, me and my writing partner have this stuff. Would you, you know, be interested in reading it and handing it off to anybody that you think might be interested? And I was like, sure. And I read the first one. I was like, wow, this is pretty good. I mean, it was a good script. Yeah. So I gave it to my agent, and he ended up signing with my agent and getting staffed on it. Sold a pilot that first year.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it was crazy. Can you imagine that?
First
agent he meets with, Robbie sets it up with his agency, and they're like, yeah, we love him. We'll sign him. And then he sells a pilot immediately. Yeah.
Incredible.
Like, what?
Incredible. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, anyway. He's a really nice human being. He's a good man because he learned to be a good human from Star Trek. He's a Star Trek fan.
There you go.
Well, of course he's a good human.
Yes.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
And also an entrepreneur.
Yes, he is. Yes. Yes, he is.
And
very
not diminutive either.
And not diminutive.
Okay. Great experience. Super fun. I can't wait to see how they're going to put this or what platform this is going to go on. So I'm excited. Yeah.
Awesome.
So I play the best friend of the lead And lead is played by Lucas Bryant, who is a series regular on Haven and a bunch of other things. He's from Canada, super nice guy, but he's a doctor. I'm a doctor and I'm his best friend. So he's sort of going back to Missouri, to his home state, the character, and he's visiting with his mom and dad. And there's family issues, but he's calling me constantly for advice, basically. So that's why my character exists in essence. Yeah.
Josh mention, I feel like he mentioned to me at one point about this movie that it was a bit autobiographical. Did he ever talk about that?
No, he did not say that.
I mean, he's not a doctor, I think he put some of his life story into it.
Well, my character is Will, and Will is a real person in his life. Will is actually a personal trainer in California. Uh-huh. My character has two children, and they're named Dutch and Onyx, and Dutch after Predator, the character in Predator, and Onyx after the League of it's a DC comic book character, basically. Yeah. And this personal trainer in Los Angeles, this Will, the real Will, does have two kids, and they are named Dutch and Onyx after those characters. So
maybe that's the part. Maybe it's not like a cathartic childhood story. It might just be that he pulled from different parts of his
parts
life.
Of his life.
He did say that.
Yeah. So it was a lot
of fun. Awesome. Yeah. Awesome.
And when will we see this? When does it come out?
Oh, goodness. I have no, absolutely zero ideas, but I gave everyone the title, so you can look it up, I guess.
It might be a while, but Josh has made a bunch of these movies as a director, writer, and also as a producer. He's produced some scripts by other people. So he's got a pipeline. He's now become a lifetime businessman.
Yes. So what he's been doing is he's been filming Lifetime movies, and he says that it takes about, I said, so, but he's filming Lifetime movies in order to get enough capital to do his own projects. So this movie is one of his own projects. So I said, oh, so you go one Lifetime movie, then one of your own. He goes, oh, no. It takes he said eight. He goes, eight Lifetimes gives me enough to do one of my own. So I'm like, okay. So this is his own personal project that we filmed. Yeah.
And ladies and gentlemen, there's a lesson. Nobody really makes a lot of money in our business.
definitely not doing Lifetime movies. They don't have big budgets.
No. All right.
Well, good. All right. Yeah. We've got some birthdays.
We do. Mm-hmm.
Jenny B has a birthday on August 6th. Happy birthday, Jenny.
Happy birthday, Jenny.
Happy birthday, Jenny. And also we have Preston M. Preston M's birthday is on August 9th. Happy birthday to Preston.
Happy birthday, Preston.
Happy birthday, Preston.
M.
Is M for and many more. Maybe.
Yes, maybe.
We have a new prophet, I think, Garrett, don't we?
Yes, we do. I totally forgot, but here we go. We have a brand new prophet. So congratulations to Carrie Roberts on being our newest prophet. Congrats.
Thank you, Carrie. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Welcome, Carrie. You're going to have a blast.
Yes.
And you're basically a god now. Now that you're a prophet. Okay.
You're a Bajoran.
You talk to gods.
You're a Bajoran god now. Okay, let's start with our poetry synopsis.
All right, I've done this a couple times where I write a haiku. I mean, I don't write a haiku. I write a limerick. I write a limerick, and then don't like it, and so I write another one. So
I have two. Again. Oh, hey, double the fun. Let's go. Let's start with the first one.
Yeah. So the first one I'm going to read is my second one. I think it captures the plot a little better, and then I'll read the first one I wrote.
Okay.
Here we go. A secure peace summit, O'Brien helps arrange. When he returns, everyone's acting strange. He can't trust anyone, so he goes on the run. The plan is head engineer, replicant exchange.
That's
the plot that gets the plot out.
I'm
gonna read my other one.
Okay.
All right, here's the other one. On the station, O'Brien's in a bit of a jam. So he decides to make a run for it and scram. Everyone was acting bizarre, so he records a personal memoir about an awkwardly long physical exam.
That was my first.
I like that one.
I love that bizarre one and memoir.
That's great. I know.
But when you said in a bit of a jam, I thought after Run For It, he's on the lam, is what I thought you were going to say.
Oh, that would have worked too.
Yes.
I like Scram.
Scram works good. Scram works good. I like, and so that one was the original one or the second one? What's the first one that I wrote?
But I didn't feel like it.
You didn't think that was enough? Come on, Robbie. Right. Come on, Robbie.
Get a life.
I know. I'm just sitting there writing poems.
Oh my God. Okay. Here's my haiku. And then after that, do you have anything, Armin, today for?
Yes, I have a definition.
Okay, great.
He's very responsible, Garrett.
All right.
Much more responsible than us.
Yes. Agreed. Here we go. Here's my haiku for Whispers. Chief knows something's up. Coffee double strong and sweet. Wrong chief the whole time. There you go.
That's good. You got a lot of good stuff in there.
Thanks, you know, you said coffee, double strong, double sweet. I thought that was going to really play a major role in the denouement of the episode. It didn't.
It didn't.
I thought that was certainly leading to something.
Yes.
Because I don't think I ever remember him being such an addict to that particular
thing. No.
Never.
No.
I don't think so.
He never says that. But I thought that was the duplicates, you know, weird.
Don't give anything away.
All right. Yeah. We won't say anything.
Etymology.
I guess that means a cue for me.
That's your cue.
Yes. So from the Oxford English Dictionary, the word is whisper.
Yes.
It is from the Old English, and I don't think I'm pronouncing this right because it starts with an H. Hawisprian. And that, by the way, that original root of that word was originally only said in Northumberland.
Okay. And so it's very regional kind of thing.
Very regional, and then it spread to the rest of the English language. But the definition I have from the OED is a secret or slight utterance, mention or report, a suggestion, insinuation, hint, light rumor, communicated in a whispering voice. And that is the definition from the OED.
I mean, there are elements of that definition that I can connect to this, but I'm not sure what they intended with this title.
You mean the writers? Why did they name it this?
Yeah. Considering, I sort of can think about why they did it, but it's not an ideal title for this episode.
Could it be Everyone But O'Brien are whispering amongst themselves behind his back, maybe?
Yes, okay. I think so. But then to know that, it is to know, you know, the ending of the episode.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not the ideal title to me. It just never, right. I never connected it. Anyway, okay. Whispers, maybe they're whispering behind his back. Okay, maybe it's just not a great title. It's a vague reference to what happens in this
episode.
It's
very vague
at best.
Yeah,
at best.
Yes. Let's talk about guest stars.
Okay.
All right. So we have good old Rosalind Chow. We have Hannah Hatte, of course, Keiko O'Brien, Molly O'Brien, Susan Bay as Admiral Rollman. Todd Waring is Ensign DeCurtis.
And Todd is a very good friend of mine, but I didn't know him when he shot this episode.
Oh, how did
he's
you
really
end up meeting
good,
him?
By the way.
Yes, he is. Todd, and God, he's gorgeous in this episode.
Yeah, he's very handsome.
I did not know him when he looked like that. No offense, Todd. Todd is a member of Antaeus, the theater company that I help run.
Got it.
And he's a wonderful, wonderful actor. We did Macbeth together. We spent a lot of time together. So he's a wonderful actor and producer and writer. So I know him as an older person, older than that really gorgeous person.
he's very handsome. I was thinking the whole time, you know, that he was on the second season of DS9. I have no doubt he was up for the role of Tom Paris. I don't know why he wouldn't have been. It was right around the timing of our show.
It's possible.
Yeah. I would have cast him as Tom Paris.
I'll ask him.
I'd be curious.
Yeah.
Because he was really good. I liked him a lot.
Yeah.
I thought he was great.
We have another name here. We have Philip Lestrange as Kotu.
That was Phil Lestrange. I did a play with Philip Lestrange.
You know Phil Lestrange?
Oh my God.
What play did you do with Phil Lestrange?
I did Antigone at the Lincoln Center.
When was that, Robbie?
1988.
Oh my God.
Probably.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah, I knew Phil Lestrange. Yeah.
My goodness. What did he play in the play? What was Phil's role? Do you remember?
I can't remember.
What did you play?
Yeah, what was your role?
I played the love interest for Antigone. Haman.
Okay.
Yeah, and Phil played one of the dads or something, I think. I can't remember.
Okay.
This was Lincoln Center had an educational arm, so they would mount these productions at Lincoln Center and run them very briefly in the summer. And then
which theater did they use?
They used
Beaumont or the other one, the smaller one?
They actually we performed at Juilliard, in the big theater at Juilliard, which is crazy because I had gone to Juilliard, but I never got to perform in the big theater because I left early. So I came back a couple of years later and did this for Lincoln Center Theater. But this was they'd run it briefly in the summer, and the schools would all come by from all over the tri-state area, really, other places too. And then they would put in for if they wanted this show to come to their school system. Wow. It was meant to tour later on. So the New York cast, me and Phil Lestrange and some of those actors, not all of us were able to go on the tour or even wanted to go on the tour. But doing that New York run was really fun. So it was a brief run in the early summer. I think it was like June or something.
Have you crossed paths with him since 1989 or whatever? You haven't bumped into him anywhere?
But I had no idea, and I didn't look up the cast. So that's crazy. Now I'm looking him up.
Yeah. It's a small world, but I wouldn't want to paint it.
Yes. Sorry, that was great. Thank you for that, Armin. I love that. Can I please say that in the future?
Absolutely, yeah. I've been using it for years.
I love it.
It's because my father was a house painter. So that's why.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Phil Lestrange is still alive. He's 82 years old. Yeah. He was on Next Generation. He did a bunch of several Law and Orders.
He didn't do Voyager, did he? Was he on our show too?
No.
No. Okay.
He was mostly a New York theater guy.
All right. So
that's
TNG.
Why a bunch of Law and Orders in there.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, sorry to digress, but I didn't realize that I knew that actor.
Well, it's always great when we find out names that are familiar to us.
And Susan Nimoy is, of course, I'm assuming, is Leonard's wife.
Susan Nimoy?
Yeah.
It says Susan Bay.
Susan Bay is
Oh, that's his wife. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
I didn't make that connection either.
I'm not 100% sure, but I'm 93% sure.
Wow.
I bet you're right. I spent some time with Susan, but I didn't recognize that.
And maybe I have it wrong, but maybe I just made that assumption.
Hold on. You're right. I just looked it up. Spouse is Leonard Nimoy from 1989 until he passed away. Yeah. She was married to him. That's his widow.
Yeah.
So
Susan, I went to the theater with them a couple of times.
With Leonard and Susan?
Leonard and Susan. I didn't make that connection either. Wow. Whoa. Thank you, Armin.
And of course, Terry's ex-mother-in-law.
Right.
Right.
That's right. Oh my gosh. Goodness. This cast has a lot of connections for us.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Here's our episode. So we start in the runabout. Boom. The runabout comes out of the wormhole, flying super fast. Miles O'Brien is inside. He's alone. He seems off in this first scene to me. Immediately I was like, he's not funny. Usually Miles O'Brien's kind of got a, you know, that working man kind of vibe.
Yeah.
It was something.
Is that what you got from it? Cause that's not what I got from it. I felt like this scene was shot before anything else was shot. Like this was like the first, it just seemed like there's supposed to be tension. There's supposed to be a lot of tension, but it seems so lackadaisical, so like calm and so, it didn't seem.
Really?
Yes, to me, that's what I got. I was like, why is he so casual?
I literally wrote very tense.
I know you wrote tense, but there's a line in there, Robbie, where he says like, I don't know, I may not live through this. And it's so casually said that I was like, why are the stakes not high enough? Why are they?
But he also says in his log, in the middle of leaving the log, he pauses to say, computer, coffee, Jamaican blend, double sweet. Like yes. He's literally ordering coffee in the middle of this. So
yes, he
I
is.
Thought his tone was, I totally bought it.
Okay.
Now, forgive me. Speaking of the log, I believe this is the first time that I've ever seen a log where you're actually witnessing the character making the recording. So that's slightly bizarre.
Mm.
That's slightly bizarre that that's being done, which I think does sort of set the tone that there's something slightly off about this.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So you guys all bought it.
I bought it.
Yeah.
I bought it that he was off and something was wrong, but he didn't know exactly.
I knew that was going on, but didn't you guys feel like when you wrote in your notes tense, I didn't see tense at all. I just thought, really? Okay, something's off. Yeah. And by the way, we skipped over writer. Writer is Paul Robert Coyle, and director is Uncle Les Landau. I just want to throw that.
Oh, yeah. I saw Les was doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. I bought the
Tenseness of
mystery
it?
Mystery thriller of it. Like that it was in that sort of tone rather than red alert, everything's... It was a nice, tense way to come into the story for me.
Okay, okay.
But we do know from what he says in the log that there's something slightly off because he says, I want to set the record straight for the last 52 hours.
Right.
So something needs to be corrected. We're being told that something's ajar, something's amiss.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It reminded me a bit of on Voyager, there was an episode where Paris was in the brig for a month, and Tom Paris started leaving this diary, talking to the computer. And so you're sort of, the whole story was framed around him recording this letter to his father or something like that.
Right. And that's how this one sets
that
up.
This one felt a little bit in that structurally, the dramatic structure of this felt sort of wrapped around this log that O'Brien was leaving.
And to add to the things being amiss, is the fact that normally episodes start on the station. It's usually Sisko who's doing the log, but usually it's on the station, or we get a picture of the station and we know and the log is coming up.
Mm-hmm.
This all of a sudden we're in a runabout and O'Brien's by himself. This sets the tone of there's something amiss. There's something not exactly normal about this.
Right.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, so the log is going on. At the end of this log, at the end of this opening scene, O'Brien says, I'm trying to remember the first time I noticed things were wrong. It seems to me it was, it had to be the first morning after I got back to the station. And that's when we kind of fade into, so we go back in time, flashback to him waking up in his bedroom, mm-hmm. and he reaches over for his wife, but Keiko's not there.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gets up, he comes in, goes in the dining area. Keiko and Molly are having breakfast, and we learn it's 5:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I got up at like 4:30 in the morning today. So I can relate to why I just wake up early.
Yeah.
But it's 5:30 in the morning, and immediately Roz Chow she was tense. She was
guarded is what I thought. She's very sort of, she just was, she had, to me, she had just kind of cut off all emotion towards her husband. It was just like, nope, I'm going to give you information and I'm not going to get anywhere close to you. And it was definitely odd. I had no idea what was going on. I was like, what is happening in this?
I thought she was mad at him.
Okay.
It seemed angry to me.
She did seem angry, but it is a tribute to Rosalind Chow's acting that we knew something was amiss without her having said anything.
Yeah, she didn't say anything. Yeah. And even little Hannah, Molly is just like, no, I'm not going to give you a kiss, whatever. There's tension there, too. There's something going on.
Yeah, and he's very confused in all of this. Mm-hmm. He's like, what did I do to deserve that? And then Keiko asks, how was your mission? What did you do? She seems to be sort of quizzing him a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And he says the Paratas put him through this basic security training because they're about to have some really important peace talks.
Yeah.
And Miles was there helping. We'll learn later that I think Odo was on Bajor during all this. Mm-hmm. So Miles was by himself, I guess, mm-hmm. with the Paratas.
No, there would be no reason for Odo to go with O'Brien on a diplomatic mission. There would be no reason for that.
Mm.
So O'Brien went by himself, but yeah, Keiko asks him. He says it was just basic security training, and then Keiko decides to go to work, and she's going to take Molly at 5:30 in the morning.
Right.
Now, I get up early, but I don't wake up Rebecca and drag her out to do things at 5 in the morning. So
that's probably good that you don't do that.
Yeah, probably is.
But he does offer to drop Molly off at daycare on his way to ops. And immediately Keiko's like, no, I'm just taking her with me, which is very odd to Chief because he's thinking, oh, what? This makes no sense. Why would she go to the school with you? And Keiko comes up with this kind of a lame answer. There's a Vulcan program that teaches basic problem solving skills. I want to show her that. So again, Chief is completely perplexed as to what is going on. This is so bizarre.
It's all weird. By the way, Armin, we've been in the O'Brien's quarters a lot. I thought about this, but we haven't been in other people's quarters. Like, we haven't been in Quark's quarters maybe once.
You rarely do. Yeah, you rarely get into Quark's quarters. And you do get into Kira's, and you do get into Sisko's.
Yes, Sisko's.
But rarely Dax's, rarely Quark's. I don't think you ever go into Bashir. Maybe you do, but I don't
can't remember.
Well, we go to Quark's quarters when the Negus is there. You're entertaining the Negus for dinner, so that we see it a little bit there.
We saw it a little bit.
But you know, the quarters are all the same place. It's just
redressed, obviously.
Change the lighting color and.
Yeah. Well, I just want to bring up one thing in this little scene, just the fact that O'Brien offers to drop Molly off at daycare. I didn't even know there was a daycare on the station. Oh, yeah. Like, where's the daycare? Has anyone ever talked about the daycare before?
That's Morn's job. Morn runs the daycare.
Morn runs the daycare.
Yeah. Morn's Mighty Mites is the name of the daycare, actually. All right.
It's good. It's good because, you know, at the beginning, in the first episode, they had to set up a school. So,
right.
So, you know, no one spoke about daycare at that time. And one doesn't see that many children of Molly's age on the show. So,
you don't.
Because union reasons, you know, and California law, working conditions reasons. So, so the daycare center must either have one or at the most two people in it.
And they care for one.
Which would be okay for Morn. Which would be all right for Morn.
Yeah, that'd be fine for Morn.
Morn can have one or two.
All right. Well, we go to the security office next. Work is underway on this wall panel. Mm-hmm. And O'Brien comes down. He finds an engineer working on the panel. And O'Brien
engineer. A gorgeous.
Very handsome.
Very handsome.
Very handsome. Very charming.
When my wife saw Todd in that shot, she went, "Oh my God, I had no idea he looked like that."
Exactly. I'm telling you, I felt like my role of Tom Paris was threatened by this actor from 30 years ago. I was like, "Wow, why didn't he get the role?"
Then that role would have been Lieutenant Todd Paris, is what it would have been.
Yes. Anyway, O'Brien walks up. He's very aware that everybody's starting early. He even comments on like, everybody's getting an early start. Keiko's getting an early start. You're already into this.
Yeah.
He's a little annoyed that DeCurtis jumped in, and DeCurtis says, "Well, Sisko, you know, the commander told me it was a direct order.
Right.
So you're going to have to talk to him." And Miles is annoyed, but he lets him continue.
Because he's not being looped in on anything. No one's telling him anything, and he's the chief.
So Brian is walking on the promenade when he spots Keiko and Sisko whispering or something. So he hides behind a pillar. So they're being sneaky. Keiko and Sisko are being sneaky.
Are they being sneaky? They're talking in public. They're not behind. They're not in an alcove.
They're sort of like
how
in each other, leaning in. There's a leaning in.
There's nothing like, okay, fine. Go ahead.
I thought so.
I did not see that. Continue.
But, you know, it's another thing to point out. This whole episode is from O'Brien's perspective.
It's his POV and it the entire be. Time. Yeah.
Yeah. The audience is feeling what this Miles O'Brien that we're following, what he's feeling. We're in that POV. Mm-hmm. And it was well done.
Yeah.
Good job, Les Lando.
that's also the writing, you know.
It is the writing too. But even like the way that Les kept having this kind of theme of Steadicam shots in the promenade that we're always picking up. We're not way back in the balcony with the camera looking down at Miles O'Brien from a distance. We're right up with him. The camera was always with Miles in his POV. I thought it was that those little things make a difference. That where Les put the camera, it does make you feel like you're the audience is wherever he puts the camera. And for this episode, the camera was right with Miles all the time.
Yeah.
We go from there into the runabout. We're back to the present, back to our log entering.
Yes.
Our story.
Mm-hmm.
Miles is heading into the heading towards the Parada system. He scans for any warp signatures, asks the computer, anything behind me? Anybody following me? Computer says yes. The runabout Mekong is trailing him. And O'Brien decides to wait until he's going to stay at warp. And he realizes they're going to wait until he drops out of warp to kind of grab him. So he continues his personal log, keeps telling the story.
Doesn't even say why he's going to the Parada. There's no explanation whatsoever. We're just
Totally in the dark, as we should be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in his log, he mentions maybe it's a surprise party, although my birthday's not until September. But that's what it feels like. It feels like they're planning a surprise party.
And so he doesn't like those parties either. He can't stand surprise parties.
Yes. Anyway, he over this log, he's arriving into ops for the first time in the episode when Bashir approaches him in ops and he says, you know, O'Brien, you finally need to have this physical exam. You've been avoiding it. Mm-hmm. And O'Brien really doesn't want to have this physical. Bashir even says, I may have to pull rank and order you, which feels a little aggressive in that friendship. That's when Sisko arrives and immediately Bashir mentions the physical exam and Sisko orders O'Brien to do it. That's an order. Stop everything. That's a priority. You need to go have this physical. And I think O'Brien even asked for a private word. He says at that point, you know what? Can we talk, Commander? Can I talk to you for a minute? And that's when they head in his office. Sisko apologizes at first when they first arrive in his office. He's like, I'm sorry. I should have included you on the De Curtis thing. Mr. Handsome guy down in the hallway. He was just so beautiful. I had to say, yes, go do it. No, that's not what
Can you just say Ensign in Handsome? Just say Ensign Handsome.
Ensign Handsome.
Ensign Handsome. That's good.
It's hard to say, though.
I'll tell Todd.
He was Ensign Handsome.
And he's like, he's got a running thing in this podcast.
Yeah.
Of being the most handsome man.
Please tell Todd to listen to this episode of the podcast.
Okay, I
think he'll get he will be tickled pink in hearing his name and Ensign Handsome at the same time.
I will tell him.
Good.
Sisko apologizes, says, you know, I just should have included you, but I wanted to get things going. But he goes, by the way, I want to know about these Parada people. You know, the things you don't put in a report. The secret things or something.
Which is weird also, right? Coming out of his mouth.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, it makes him seem ominous, like Sisko's the bad guy. Because now we think Miles is
good. We don't know anything. We know nothing.
And that adds to O'Brien's point of view. You know, we have to see this because Les did shoot it this way. We must see everything from O'Brien's point of view.
Yeah. Yeah, and Sisko does seem a bit
off,
insincere or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Doesn't O'Brien tells him about the odor that they have? That they have some
which
kind
didn't
of...
play either.
No, that is why mention this stuff if it doesn't even land on anything later, right?
Exactly.
It's so bizarre. Unless the scene was cut out.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. It would have been funny when O'Brien comes in later, opens the door, and there's all the
odor,
the aliens. If Sisko was like, or he had a gas mask on or something.
Yeah. It was an opportunity for that.
Was an opportunity. But he says they have an odor from these secretions in their skin, and it gets stronger when they get really upset.
Yeah.
Sisko says, well, I'll try not to upset them. But Sisko tells him, I want you to go work on the pylons. Don't work on the security stuff.
Yeah.
The upper pylons are down again. And O'Brien's really confused here because he said, I just fixed those. I rebuilt them all. They should be fine. It makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
But Sisko says, physical first, go get your exam, then go straight to the pylon. So he's, yeah, he feels like he's trying to keep him away from something else that's happening.
Yes.
You know, it definitely feels
like that. And because he even, I was going to say the elephant in the room is we've never seen this from O'Brien before. Why is he so upset about getting the physical? Why is he putting up such a fight about getting a physical? It's not that he doesn't trust his doctor. He does. I'm sure every time O'Brien's been hurt, he has no problem, you know, getting fixed up.
Yeah.
So what is the problem? And that, of course, plays into the other point of view. So, but from continuity standpoint, I didn't understand why he was so upset with this. Just from continuity. For the plot, I understand, but not from the continuity standpoint.
Okay.
That's fair. Funny because it didn't bump me at all. Now that you bring it up, I do question it. But at the time, I guess I bought it because I was like, oh, it's kind of a caricature, a stereotype of like the working class tough guy who just doesn't want to take care of himself.
Right.
He's too busy. I got to go fix the car. I got to go clean the garage. I got to whatever. Yeah. You know, it's that everyman sort of doing good self-care.
Yeah, so it seemed par for the course for you, Robbie.
Yeah, I kind of bought it in a general way that, you know, culturally, that type of working guy.
Yeah, they feel like they're in good shape. They don't need
prioritize.
To do that.
Yeah, I'm fine.
It's the last priority for them.
Yeah, maybe. Okay. But that's a good point, Armin.
Yeah.
Anyway, Miles asks about Sisko talking to Keiko. He said, is everything okay? I saw you talking to Keiko. And Sisko mentions, oh, yeah, it's about Jake. His grades are really slipping. He's struggling in school. And O'Brien reassures him, you know, Keiko loves him. She likes him a lot. She'll help him. She'll get him through this. And then he leaves, and there's a long kind of evil look from Sisko as he leaves. I don't know. That one seemed a little over the top to me, that after O'Brien left. I was
that
like,
long look?
Yeah, it was kind of a long look, and then it felt a little arch in a way that didn't need to happen there.
And it's antithetical to what Les has been doing with the program.
Yeah.
That's seeing it from Sisko's point of view, and not, this is not something Brian sees.
Yeah.
So that is antithetical to the thrust of what Les has been doing.
Yeah, I hadn't put it in that framing, but you're absolutely, that's why it bumped me.
That's why it was weird.
O'Brien's gone. Why is he acting so evil? It was just a look. He didn't have any lines. I think he even pulled up the security report or something. But it just felt arch to me.
Yes.
Yeah. So the next thing that happens, even
is the
though
physical.
Yeah, O'Brien doesn't want it to happen, but
no,
it's happening.
It's gonna happen.
Taking a long time. That I can understand. He doesn't want this, but it is taking a very long time. Longer, one would assume, than most of the physicals that he's endured. So this is taking a really long time.
I was impressed with Sid's ability to use multiple devices. He had two hands going. Like, as far as I know, Babacardo never always had one prop. Or if he had two, it was the thing that came off of the medical tricorder that he scanned and was holding the tricorder. So it became like that. But he had two completely
different
devices.
Tools. Yeah, he's juggling multiple activities.
Everything.
Wow.
Yes. So
here's the other activity impressive. That happened scene as the camera pushed in. And Sid reached his hand down below frame and said, cough. I was like, oh, my God, they're doing this? And then he even goes, everything okay in that department? They made a whole the doctor grabbing your privates joke that I thought was one of my favorite things in this. It was brief, but it was amazing.
Okay, my favorite thing was the actual half-hearted coughs that he had. It was like, he didn't even really...
yes.
He didn't do a real cough, which was funny to me. But
yeah,
it's possible that Cullum wasn't interested in playing that particular beat.
He's like, I'm gonna show you how unenthused I am about this scene by coughing like this. Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he says, well, your sense of humor seems normal enough, Bashir says. Yeah. O'Brien says, I don't have a sense of humor. And that's when his hand goes down, Bashir goes, cough. He coughs. He goes, "How's the sex life?"
And he repeats, "I don't have a sense of humor.
I don't have a sense of humor." And he goes, "Cough, cough." And he coughs again. He goes, "Everything all right in that department?" It's just, I love that moment.
Yeah.
I almost put it in my limerick. It was so.
Oh, it almost made a debut in your limerick, but you kept it out.
Good comedy.
It is. Yeah.
But he does, Bashir does ask at one point, "How's your mother and father doing?" And Miles is annoyed. He says, "You know, my mother died 2 years ago. My father got remarried. I told you all about this." So there is an odd disconnect. And you think at this point, Bashir is the one.
Right.
That's lying or something. But I guess we'll see the perspective later that he was sort of testing him. He was trying to.
But again, from O'Brien's point of view, things are off. And we know things are off because we know from the log entry that for O'Brien, things are off.
Yeah.
And now he's remembering these things that have promulgated this response in him. So we're seeing that Sisko has been a little off. Todd's character has been a little off. Keiko has been a little off. Everyone's been a little off.
Yes.
And we're just getting more and more information that validates that opinion.
Yes.
I have a... Remind me to ask this question later, because it's a spoiler, and I don't want to spoil this for people listening to the podcast, get ahead of ourselves. But I want to remember to ask this question because, we're all from his point of view, and there's a big... I guess there wouldn't be an episode if they did what I'm thinking. But anyway, we'll get there. So, he asks him about his parents. Then Miles thinks at one point that, oh my God, I'm sick. That's why you're doing this. That's why you're doing this very long. I'm dying, aren't I? Basically starts getting paranoid.
Happy birthday.
Yes. And when he jumps up, did you see all the ties in the back of his gown? Like the classic?
Yeah.
That's no.
It's great. I like that a lot. I like the ties in the back,
The ties in the back. It's just like nothing's changed, really. It's a little more tailored, I guess, than the open flaps.
And a little tighter on the ties, too, for that matter.
Yes. But it was a nice homage to our classic hospital gown. Our
current medical gowns, yes.
Bashir, at this point, when O'Brien starts panicking, Bashir gives him a clean bill of health. He goes, no, you know what? You're fine. In fact, he's so healthy that he can walk fast through the promenade, and Jake has to run and catch up to him.
Yes.
And Jake catches O'Brien. Yes.
And speaking of Jake, two things. I'm looking at that scene. I'm thinking, oh, my God, he's sprouted up.
Yeah.
I got the impression that at that moment he's taller than Cullum is.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, he will ultimately be taller.
Yes, he will ultimately. But in that shot, I thought, oh, he's about a half an inch taller than Cullum.
Wow. Right.
Yeah. It was an earlier episode in my reaction videos, Armin, where I noticed that he had sprouted up like a beanstalk. I was like, my goodness. From the last time we saw him, it looks like he grew an extra 6 inches. It really does.
Do you know how old he was at this point in the series?
I would venture, and I don't know. So it's just a guess. I would say at this point he's 15, maybe 16.
Yeah, so he would be definitely well into puberty by then.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
On the topic of his height, of his sprouting up, I think it's good that they have already established that he and Nog like to sit in that corner on the upper level, because now, you know, when you're seated, that sort of is the equalizer in terms of height, because at this point he has left Aaron Eisenberg in the dust in terms of height, clearly. So them standing together is going to look awkward. You really, really have the luck of having already established this sitting thing that they do, which I'm guessing they continue to do, Armin. They always sit in that little upper
they don't
part
always,
the...
but yeah, they do.
Yeah.
They do. And that relationship will begin to peter out, and maybe that's one of the reasons.
Really? Uh-huh.
There'll always be a friendship, but that the
childhood
they're happening
kind of,
them happening all the time, that's going to peter out.
Okay.
Right. Well, in this scene, the first scene with Jake talking to O'Brien, he asked for some help with a subspace transceiver project. Which sort of makes Miles feel a little old, because the way Jake talks about the transceiver, it's like vintage. But Miles says, I'd be happy to help you get your grades back up.
Yeah.
And Jake says, what are you talking about? My grades are awesome. My grades are great.
Right.
I just want to keep them up.
So now Brian knows something's amiss here. Yeah.
Now, excuse me, I'm just looking at my notes. It is indeed this scene, Mark
Shepard. It is. Okay.
Okay.
So I'm looking at my notes, it's right there.
He just plays a human. He plays a human on the promenade. Is that what it is?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Either that or a Bajoran. I didn't notice the nose, but he could have had a nose on. But yeah, he's just sitting there. He's just, you know.
Wow. I wonder how he felt. No Mourn makeup.
He was very happy about it.
Yes.
These two scenes, so this scene, the first scene where Jake asks for help, and then there's a next scene coming up soon where Jake has the transceiver and they're again in the promenade. I paused at one point to make some notes and I got mixed up because they're shot very similarly. They both start on two people. In this first scene, there's two background actors that are sitting there and then we find O'Brien. In the next time we're in the promenade, the two people are Jake and this alien. Starts on two people and then it goes to O'Brien. Nice. So these two scenes sort of, to me, I got confused here because I paused. I was like, wait, I've seen this scene. No, I haven't.
Yeah. But they're very similar in their setup.
Very similar.
I wonder if Les shot them, you know, right after each other. Probably would make sense to shoot them right after each other.
Yeah.
And since it was already lit for one scene, why not just keep the same lighting and make your day a little bit quicker?
A little bit quicker. Hmm? Yeah. The biggest reason it got me confused is there's only one scene between those two promenade scenes. So they're walking the promenade in the same direction, same shot, and then one scene away, and then we go back and do the same thing again. So it was a little
repetitive.
A little bit to me. So Miles is working alone in this big round airlock, which I love this shot. It was very cool. And he's back to his log. He says, Sisko was telling the truth about one thing, the upper pylons failed. And it doesn't make any sense because the new pressure locks he installed seem to be working fine. So he's just confused.
And there is a lovely shot of the camera getting closer and closer to O'Brien, which I really enjoyed a great deal. I thought, oh, that's really nice. Really nice shot.
Well, it's a nice opportunity, these kind of scenes, when there's a voiceover and the actor is just doing business. And so the camera has an opportunity to kind of move as that voiceover kind of carries the scene, the story.
And therefore, you don't have to memorize any lines.
Yes.
You don't have to worry about blocking. You just have to be involved in an activity. That's it.
Great scenes.
Yeah. And let us, before we go any further, let us acknowledge stuff I've acknowledged many times before, the superior acting talents of Colm Meaney.
Yeah,
that you can leave a camera on him. He doesn't have to say anything. It's fascinating to watch Colm act.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's great in this episode. He's really good.
Phenomenal actor. Phenomenal actor.
We'll be right back after this message from our sponsor.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
After this voiceover, he leaves the airlock area where he's working, goes to find DeCurtis, wants to check his work. And DeCurtis says, we did a clean sweep of the Parada quarters. Everything's fine. And Miles says, well, I want to see. And he says, no, the security seal's already been activated. We can't open this door. Only Kira can open it. So Miles calls Kira. Then Sisko immediately interrupts, says he wants the pylons to be O'Brien's top priority. That's an order. Mm-hmm. So O'Brien leaves, but he stops around a corner, looks back, and there's DeCurtis, thinks the coast is clear, and DeCurtis goes in to the door he said was just sealed that couldn't be opened.
Can we not call him DeCurtis? Can we just say Ensign Handsome, please?
Yes. Thank you. Yes. Okay.
Yes.
The most handsome man on the station opens the door and goes inside.
Okay.
And there's a lot of handsome people. One of them is with us today. But
you're very kind. But I'm no Todd Waring. No.
you are not a young Todd Waring. No, you are. Well, who is? Very
and
few
I'm,
are.
And I'm grateful for that. Enormously grateful for that.
So O'Brien sees this, and then we go back to the promenade. This is the scene where I got confused. I was like, didn't I just see this scene? Jake and O'Brien. Jake has the transceiver, though, that he talked about in the earlier scene. ask O'Brien if it's the right one. Miles says yes, and he says he'll come by later to help. And he starts to ask Jake, did anything odd happen while I was away? When suddenly Kira appears up above and calls Jake. Hey, Jake, your dad's looking for you. You need to go see him right now. And Jake leaves. Very odd. Again, from the POV of Miles. This is just insane.
Yeah.
You'd be very paranoid if all this was happening.
Mm-hmm.
Back to this beautiful airlock. O'Brien's working alone again. He finally found a crack in the RF power conduit, he says. And I can't imagine how that would have happened so deep in the system and unless someone broke it deliberately. So he's starting to see sabotage. Mm-hmm. He's starting to see all these lies and secrets. Yeah. He comes home really tired at this point. Keiko says that Jake is not going to be coming over for tutoring or help with his project, that he got sick. And Miles was like, I just saw him. He wasn't sick a minute ago. So more lies.
More weird stuff. Mm-hmm.
But the good news is Molly's having a sleepover, and it's going to be the love shack for Mr. O'Brien, Mr. and Mrs. O'Brien. Or so he thinks it's going to be the love shack.
Which I thought actually was excellent for this episode.
Yeah.
Considering what the situation is.
Yeah.
And again, wonderful work by Roslyn Chow. Maneuvering through that sticky situation.
Mm-hmm.
And keeping her eyes open during the kiss. Yes. Good job, Rosalind Chow. That's how you show uncomfortability. You never close your eyes. You're just wide open while you're smooching.
Yeah. And he picks up on it and she goes, sorry, I'm just not in the mood.
Yeah.
But she makes him a big dinner. Frickin' dough stew. I think it's frickendow or frickendow stew.
Lots of meat. I remember looking at the, a lot of meat in there.
And he says, that's strange. Yeah, I like it, but you don't like it at all. And he just finds that strange, this combination of food. It's a weird dinner she made him.
If we know what the ending is, I don't want to give anything away, but if we know, that's just the test, I suppose. She's testing.
More testing, yeah.
Okay, so it's another test. But Robbie, you didn't like the look of the stew. I thought it looked very appetizing, to be honest.
I thought it had like grubs or worms.
No, it was meat.
No!
It looked like it was moving when he...
Robbie!
When he like forked it.
No, moving stuff.
The way that he's looking
and
at it...
And you're a vegetarian. You should be disgusted by it.
I should be disgusted, but I still thought it looked good. It looked like something that people that eat meat would like to eat. Basically, so I was like, oh, that looks good. But to me in this scene, it looked like he was thinking it was poisoned, that she had put something in there.
He wasn't sure whether to take a bite or not.
She was
insisting that he eat it, and he's already got suspicions again. Wonderful look from Colm O'Brien.
So maybe
Colm Meaney, excuse me, Colm.
Did you say Colm O'Brien?
I did.
All right. That's all right. But I do think it's interesting. I almost feel like maybe the only thing he needs for sustenance is Jamaican blend, double sweet, double strength, double sweet Jamaican blend. I thought maybe that's all he needs to keep running or something.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
I love a good cup of coffee. Yes, does Armin in his Ember mug.
Will you stop advertising for free? Until you email those people, you are not allowed to talk about that Ember mug anymore. I just said it.
Oh. It's an Ember mug, but it doesn't have coffee.
Oh, tea? What do you have in there? Tea?
Tea.
Look at that. Why didn't you send me an Ember mug, Robbie? My God.
He didn't send it to me.
I didn't send it. I just recommend it.
Oh,
I just saw him drinking out of it and went, oh, that looks really like a good idea.
You copied him. Okay.
I emulated him, actually.
Yes, emulated.
I still expect Robbie to send me one anyway. That's going to be my Christmas gift.
That'll be your Christmas gift.
All right. Well, there you have it.
Well, O'Brien is paranoid about the food. He decides he's not hungry, doesn't eat anything, and leaves another personal log. This is the Miles O'Brien memoir. Episode. He says he doesn't know if anything was wrong with the stew or not. And he went back to check later, but Keiko had already put it in the disposal. She had already cleaned it up.
Yeah.
But he is absolutely certain that this is not his wife. This is not my Keiko. He's
right.
And then we go back to the present for a moment, and he I think there's a break. There was a commercial break there. So we came back and he says, computer, play back that last sentence. So it was a way of bridging the commercial break, probably.
Yes.
It was like end on a log and then come back and do a little recap of the log.
I like it.
Yeah. We were a little short that week.
Yeah. Yeah, play my whole memoir one more time.
We're 2 minutes short. Well, what can we do? We can replay the log. Okay, good.
Yeah.
But yes. Yeah, and then he listens to a sentence of his own log, which I thought was
that's
very funny.
And he says, "You're right, she wasn't." So he's talking to himself.
He's talking to himself. Yes. So he says, "Continue log," and he says, "He didn't get much sleep. He waited for Keiko." Basically, he goes to his computer and he's going to have the computer check every possible foreign item or poison or anything that could have infiltrated the ship. Yeah. He's checking chemical agents, bioactive properties. He's accessing the EM sensor grid. He's trying to figure out something happened to this station because everybody's weird.
Right.
But nothing's coming up on any of the computer logs.
So then he decides to listen to all of the officers' logs starting before he left. And this is very funny to me. You see this montage of him listening to everybody. You hear Dax's voice, you hear Cisco's voice, and it's just the most mundane, most boring stuff. But he has to go through all of this because he's trying to figure it out.
Do you remember Kira's log though? They are all mundane, except Kira goes,
"What was her?
I'm so mad about it." She's the only one.
She's the only one with emotion. That's right. That's right.
Yeah, these people are driving me crazy. And you're just getting snippets of them. Hers just popped out. I thought it was funny. So he's going through time. He went back before he left for this mission. But once it gets up to the day he returned, the computer stops and says, "Sorry, you're locked out. You don't have permission access. To listen to no access.
Access denied.
Access denied." So everything worked up until the day he returned from his mission. But after that, even his level one security clearance doesn't play. He can't play those logs.
Yeah.
This is just getting more and more suspicious. And we haven't seen Odo this whole time.
Yeah.
Which is kind of strange to me.
Mm. Renee was with his grandchildren, probably.
But it is kind of strange, especially doing the backwards math, that if they got the information we ultimately learned they got, why wouldn't they want their security officer? There's a couple of
holes
for me.
Well, certainly Odo was away on a mission himself in Bajor, but it's relatively easy to get from Bajor to the station. But
that's right.
You would think that they want that. Or perhaps, without giving anything away, they thought this was a Starfleet matter and not a Bajoran matter.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so his security clearance doesn't work to listen to any of the newer logs. And so he goes to ops and he walks all the way through ops. He kind of goes past everybody, acting very innocent and climbs down into the pit, which I love the pit.
Yeah.
He opens up a console, starts working. Immediately, DeCurtis is there.
Ensign DeHanson. Ensign D. Handsome.
Ensign D. Handsome. Suddenly appears. It's like they're constantly watching. Like every time he's just begins to like have a conversation or do something, they're definitely watching him. And Miles says he's working on the upper pylons, got to do something in here down the pit.
You're an inspiration to us all.
Yes. That was very funny.
What did you make of that line though? Was it just him sort of like throwing him off the path? He didn't want him to catch on that they all know that, you know, something's up with him. So he's like, "You know what? You're an inspiration." How did you take that? Well, I know it's funny, but I'm just curious how you,
it just felt like one of Miles's minions that works in engineering is just kissing up to the boss.
Okay.
It felt a little bit like kissing up to the boss to me.
And I thought something other. I thought it was just reassuring him that everything is fine.
Okay. That's fine. All right. I like
something
that
just in passing that anyone would say to somebody else.
Just a nice thing when there's no worries or you're just saying something nice.
Right. Yeah.
Well, Miles says, he says he wasn't exposed by the traps that were set for him, that he released the protective files. So he's not really working on the pylons down there. Mm-mm. He's releasing, he's bypassing this lock that's been put on his security clearance mm-hmm. to release those logs that he wasn't able to hear.
Right.
So he does see that they laid some traps in the computer subroutine, but he didn't get detected and was able to penetrate the security lockout. So
here's a question I have, just yes. listening to what you were just talking about. Miles is the expert at this system. And yes, he's seeing things that only an expert would see. But my question is, I suppose the answer is Ensign Handsome. But
that's always so the answer.
Who put these things in there? Because Kira can't do it. Cisco can't do it. Dax can't do it. I suppose,
Ensign Handsome
can do it. So that answers my question.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Did he ever come back on the show, Ensign Handsome?
No, that's why I don't. This was such a surprise when I saw Todd standing there in his glory. I went, oh my God, you know, why didn't they bring Todd back for more stuff?
Absolutely.
I think it's because he was just too handsome. They really couldn't have, you know.
Aside from his handsomeness, though, he was really good.
Yeah, he's a good
guy. Yeah, no, he was great.
He felt like great. A legitimate.
A regular guy.
Regular series lower regular decks kind dude of guy.
Working. Yes, yeah. For sure.
I would have great brought job. Him back for
great
sure.
Great job, Todd.
He bypasses the security lockout. We go back to his quarters. Just before he goes, two innocent crewmen pass him in the hallway. And he's so paranoid at this point. He's like watching everybody, which I love that detail.
Yeah.
He runs inside his quarters.
Right.
He does confirm that they were obsessed with his security reports when he got back, that they even broke into his private log. So
yeah.
he's picking up on what happened behind the scenes, what he wasn't aware of through these logs. He even discovers that Cisco was exchanging private secure messages from the Parada system. Mm-hmm. So this makes him even more suspicious. Like, what did these guys do? Now they've gotten to Cisco somehow.
Right.
So from his point of view, there's this possibility that Cisco is collaborating with Paradis about something nefarious. That's what I got watching. And I'm sure that's what I'm supposed to feel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did. Did you notice when he talks about, he says, they even broke into my personal logs to see what they could find in there. I hope they enjoyed reading the sexy letters to my wife.
Yeah.
It's like, ew, gross. I laughed, but I was like,
Yeah, we tend to break protocol often on our show to go places that nobody dares to go to.
Definitely. Yes. He's essentially saying that they broke into his sexting. He was texting his, exactly. You know, and,
that's
and
right.
We would never talk about that on Voyager. But you guys just, you know, you say it's so nonchalant how these things come up on your show on DS9. And, just like, yeah, this is what happened. You're like, wow.
Yeah, wait until we get into bathroom habits. Wait until we get into
what? Oh, are you being serious?
Yes, I am.
Oh, no. Okay, don't spoil it. Don't spoil it. Okay.
All right, so we go to the airlock again where he's been working. A transport has arrived at this airlock, and Miles is waiting for Odo to exit. Odo comes out. Miles says, I need to talk to you. There's a problem. We cut around a corner. Miles fills Odo in. He suspects they're doing something really bad. He can't call Starfleet or else it'll blow his cover. He wants to figure out what's going on before he loops in Starfleet or else they'll know that he's onto them. So Odo says, just act normal. Keep doing what you're doing. I'll do some investigating. So it does feel like, oh, good.
O'Brien's he has an ally.
He's got an ally. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, as an audience member, as you're watching this, you're now assuming that everyone but Odo is compromised. You think that Cisco, even Jake, everybody is a secret agent or something's going on. But, you know. And then Odo is like that lighthouse in the dark night. Like, he's the one that's going to help me.
I will differ with you on just a small matter.
Yeah.
At this point, I don't think I, as a watcher, didn't think that Jake was in on it.
Okay, you didn't feel
I will
that,
a little later. Okay. Absolutely. Yes. But not at this point.
Not yet. Not at this point. Right. Okay.
I agree with you. I didn't think Jake was in on it. He seemed the most normal. Mm-hmm. And I will differ a little bit on Odo's entrance here. I felt like Odo was acting, Renee Sneaky. Was playing it a little different than the normal Odo.
Oh.
I didn't.
You didn't? Either. Nope.
I felt like he was playing it just like normally he's a little gruff. He seems often impatient with people or very formal. And there was something a little more open and warm about this.
Than the usual off-putting.
To me,
okay.
It was, yeah. He was so open and interested and warm about it. I was like, okay. That doesn't feel like Odo's usually.
So
like,
you're,
what's right. going on? I'll take care of this. It's very ego driven. It's very sometimes you're, combative almost.
Yes. You're used to Archie Bunker Odo, and this is not Archie Bunker Odo. I got
and
you.
I wonder if that's possible. Like if they contacted Odo down in Bajor and said, hey, we're not getting anywhere. We need you back up here to help us out.
If
he was aware of some of it or. Yeah.
That's a possibility. Absolutely. It's a possibility. I would hope that that's not what happened, but it is very much a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Either way, it works.
Either way, if Odo was innocent.
I think like Jake, things have to happen for a little while longer before they're clued.
Odo's up to speed. Got it. Yeah. Either way, for me, that would work. It would work both ways. Yeah. So we go back to O'Brien's quarters. He's alone again. He's got another log. He's working on that some tiny device. He says, just in case, because he feels better having Odo on the ship. He's got an ally now, but to cover his bets, he's going to have this trick up his sleeve, whatever this little device is. We don't know.
I thought that was the device that Jake handed him.
I did too. Initially.
Sorry. I'm so confused. It's not Robbie. It's not the device.
No, I don't think so. No.
Okay. This is his ace up the sleeve thing to keep them from catching him and detecting him or something, right?
It's
something like that.
We don't know what it is now. Later on, we're gonna see what it is because it helps him get out of a jam. But
yeah,
but we don't know what it is. We go to Quark's finally. Finally, we go to Quark's.
Yeah, listen, I had a week off. I'm happy.
I get it.
Yeah, we get you. We understand.
Well, O'Brien's up in the balcony.
Yeah.
And Quark approaches.
Yeah.
Says he looks tired. He's, you know, he mentions the odds are against you, O'Brien.
Right.
O'Brien says, why? Well, you look tired. You know, have you been getting enough sleep? And O'Brien's triggered. He grabs Quark. Which
what else is new? Everybody grabs Quark.
I know, but for Robbie and I to watch this manhandling of you, Armin, our friend, is something that we don't like to watch. So we didn't like it.
I put in my notes another Quark grab.
Yeah, Ugh.
Yeah, UGH all the way. No, it was annoying. Like you can still make the point without literally shaking you so hard.
Yes.
You could break your collarbone. I mean, what is going on?
I would love to. I don't have this script. I would love to see if that's in the script or not.
I have it.
Robbie has it. So go ahead and look, Robbie. Go.
I got to get there.
That's all right. So
I'm very curious too. I want to hear if the grab is part of the script as well.
I think everybody but Jake at one time or another grabs Quark.
Yeah, I was like, or Nog. Rob and Nog have never grabbed you, right?
Dax. I don't think Dax will ever grab you. Yeah.
Okay. So we reveal Quark says the odds are against you, O'Brien. Moving camera moves to include Quark. O'Brien reacts. O'Brien, against me? What are you talking about? Quark sits down. Quark says, you know what I'm talking about. You look tired. Have you been getting enough sleep? A beat. O'Brien grabs him with a fist to the shirt and pulls him over the table.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's which he
didn't
like
do. Which he didn't do. So let's give him the benefit that he didn't pull me over the table. He pulled me, but not over the table.
Correct.
Yeah, he that would have been a major stunt to pull you across the table.
We have done that. We have done that, but it didn't happen this time.
Am I correct to say you hadn't sat down yet? Weren't you kind of next to him in a way?
I think he grabbed you closer? Standing and then you sat down.
And then you sat down afterwards. So the blocking changed a little bit from the script. So
Right.
But the grab is still there. Mm.
Armin, do you recall, this brings up a good question. We had to call the office for line changes. Do you recall if something was scripted, like pulls him over the table or something?
That wasn't de rigueur. We didn't have to do that. And I would venture to say, I don't remember exactly at all, in fact, but the changing of what was in the script as far as blocking, that was not written in stone. We could do whatever we wanted, whatever the director wanted, whatever the actors wanted. We could do that. That's what the rehearsal before the lighting was about. So I may have known that it said he sits down, but remembering my work ethics and my work habits, I probably paid no attention to the stage direction. I did whatever, what seemed right at the time. So no, we didn't have to change that. Yes, every syllable had to be checked with
Every with letter of the alphabet that changed.
Right. Yeah. That had to be checked and double checked.
Yeah, that's my memory of Voyager 2. We had flexibility on the stage directions to change those up a bit, but not the words. Not the words.
No.
Yeah. Well, Quark does sit down at some point. He wants to know about the Paradas. O'Brien asks why, and he says, well, it's good business to know about new customers. And then doesn't O'Brien say, what
rule of acquisition is that? And Quark says, one of the higher ones.
Now I'm reading into everything. I was like, wait, is this the real Quark? Because he would know every rule of acquisition. Yeah. Is there a test there? Or
this is fake Quark.
Everything was suspect to me.
Well, yeah, that's good. That's what the episode wants you to believe. That's absolutely. Right.
Yeah.
But I watched it and thought, was I aware or not aware of what the reality was? And I came up with the decision, no, I was not aware.
Okay. That plays too. I'll go with
that. I would guess that would be more, you know, high level officer information. They wouldn't let the public know that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Why would they tell Quark that? They wouldn't. Now, he might have found out. It's possible. But really, I think he actually is saying what he means.
Yeah.
He wants him to be ready for the next racquetball match.
Yeah. Yeah. I think in hindsight, it's all sincere, but there's enough just slight variations on what you expect Quark to say or do that you kind of, I was suspicious of Quark. Like,
as you should be. And as yes, he, I as, was. As, again, it's O'Brien's suspicion. We're from O'Brien's point of view.
Yeah.
It looks suspicious considering everything else that has come before. But if you took all of that away, this is just regular Quark behavior.
Yes, exactly. If you took all that away, none of this would jump out to anybody. O'Brien will not tell him anything about the Paradas. He said, I'm not talking to you about that. And then Odo calls and says, I need you in my office right away. We go up to Odo's office. He says, basically, he's a little vague. I thought he confirmed, like, yeah, O'Brien, you're right, what all the things you said. But he doesn't really say that. He says, I see what you mean, which is also
it's so vague.
What does that mean?
Yeah,
I see what you mean. And O'Brien goes, good, what'd you find out? And Odo says, sit down. How much do you know about the Paradan rebels? So he doesn't, you know, he's not giving him anything.
Right.
O'Brien starts to tell him what he knows, but he sees pretty quickly that they've gotten to Odo. Whatever this behavior he sees in everybody else, he's like, wait a minute, they got to you too. And so he gets up, starts to leave. That's when Sisko, Kira, and Bashir cut him off.
And the two scenes abut each other in that way. Quark asks, what do you know about the Parada? And then the next scene is, what do you know about the Parada rebels? So that same question now in its own way is being repeated, which should be an alarm bell and is an alarm bell.
Yes.
For O'Brien.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. That's good. That's good writing to give him the motivation to be even more paranoid here.
Now I almost wonder, Armin, if I almost feel like Quark did know now.
That's your prerogative. That's your prerogative.
Yeah,
and that's what an audience should be asking themselves.
Yeah.
Well, as O'Brien tries to make a run for it, Sisko, Kira, Bashir come in. Guns are drawn.
On the promenade, which is supposed to be a taboo. And right. In Odo's own office, they have guns. I'm really sure you're not supposed to have guns in the promenade and certainly not in Odo's office.
There they are with guns drawn. And Bashir starts to tranquilize him. Bashir says, I'm going to give you a sedative or something. Starts to give. That's when that little device comes out. It's like a flashbang. Okay.
That's what he was working on before.
Yeah, he was working on. He pulls out that thing, hits a button, and a light blinds everybody. Mm-hmm. Was there smoke there?
Yeah, there was smoke. I got the feeling that it was some sort of gas that incapacitated them, and he was able to get out. Maybe he had filters in his nose. Who knows?
Yeah,
I love
exactly. Yeah, but whatever it was, it distracted them long enough for him to make a run for it. But when he runs out, there's two security crewmen outside with guns drawn on the promenade. Mm-hmm. And he Miles has grabbed one of those phasers after his flashbang grenade. So he shoots the two crewmen. He's very good. He dodges a phaser, by the way, which is not easy to do.
Or maybe that Bajoran is a horrible aim and unable to, because it was almost point blank and he misses him. But also what's weird is that you don't ever see one Bajoran security and one Starfleet security together. It's usually two Bajoran guys that will run up, right? And I never see the mix of the two, which was interesting.
Right. That on the promenade, it should be the Bajoran security.
Correct, right? Yeah.
But it was a mix of, I noticed that too.
And then the whole promenade is set with sensors that would have been going because they have their guns. They have phasers on them. They're not supposed to have any of that there. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
O'Brien runs through the airlock after he shoots the Bajoran and Starfleet security. Mm-hmm. And he dodges. I just can't get over the dodging a phaser. Like literally they shoot the phaser and then you see Miles like lean and it just misses him.
Like the Matrix kind of?
Yes. Yes.
He was doing that.
Like, I don't know if that's possible. It's just the timing of the edit to me. It felt like, that's not possible. That you could see the phaser start heading towards him
and move out of the way. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's able to move out of the way before it reaches him.
No, anyway. That's why I say that it was a bad aim. I'm not going to go with him dodging it.
Okay, good. Okay.
And he's still tired from the racquetball, right?
Yes, exactly. We go into some corridor. He's on the run. O'Brien calls a computer to beam him to the runabout, but the computer says, no, can't do that. Locked out of that. So he tosses his comm badge, makes a run for it.
Which he should have done 20 minutes before. I mean, all of his movements are monitored by that comm badge.
Yep.
So no wonder they can show up at any moment and stop him because he's got the comm badge on. They know exactly where he is.
That's true. You're absolutely right. I didn't think about that. They're tracking him constantly. There's eyes on him because,
there's a different way they attach that comm badge than our comm badges. On Voyager, we had Velcro on the back, right? And like when he rips that thing off, it almost looks like there was a button or there was like a little snap, like a silver snap thing on.
Oh, maybe.
If, I don't know if you noticed that, Robbie, but if on his after he tears it off, you can see where the comm badge used to be. And for Voyager, it would be black Velcro and you wouldn't see it, but it was a little light colored dot almost. It could have been metallic or whatever it was. So maybe Bob Blackman had a different way of affixing the comm badges on DS9.
Maybe. Well, O'Brien runs around a corner after he tosses his comm badge. He's stopped by a force field. And we think he looks on a monitor. He sees people heading towards him. And so he decides to create hundreds of force fields. He's like, all right, you want to stop me with a force field? I'll create all the force fields I can.
Yeah.
And they have to turn them all off so that they can move. And I like how he says, thank you. And then he runs.
Yeah.
It's nice. We go into another corridor. And as O'Brien's running, he passes Jake. This is when Jake accidentally steps out. And now you can tell Jake knows what's up.
Yes, that's what I think. I think Jake knows now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially when he says, Cisco to Jake, Cisco to security. Now you know
he's part of it. When he calls.
And he goes, he's here. Now you know he knows.
Well, O'Brien thinks he's still unaware. And so he starts to tell him something very wrong is happening.
Right.
And you see Jake is terrified. And then Jake goes and calls security.
Right.
And gives the location. Jake even says, you know, surrender, just surrender. It'll be fine. So he's really, that was a sad moment to me when the kid is saying, like, when the kid's gone to the other side.
Right.
Because now there's no Odo on, there's no Odo ally. There's no Jake ally. There's no family. Keiko's gone.
He's alone.
He is alone.
The plants have body snatched everyone.
Yes. I love it.
He jumps inside a security conduit. I thought that was pretty clever. He runs, you know, he pulls a panel, goes inside, and there's like holes in it. So you see Odo, you hear Odo and feet passing.
That was very good. Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah, that was great. Odo says, check all the corners, advise people to stay where they are. And he starts climbing. Miles starts climbing through these cool tubes. There's a nice sequence. He's even going up a ladder that seems like it's hundreds of feet up in the air. That was
well, if he's going to access one of the runabouts, it wouldn't be on the prom. It wouldn't be on the habitat level. So he has to go to a upper pylon in order to get to the ship.
Got it.
So he has to climb up.
Okay. Well, that, do you remember that shot? There was actually an upshot and a downshot, but it made that ladder seem enormous to me.
It's a long way, as you can see behind me.
Yes.
It's a long way from the habitat to the pylon.
Yeah. Well, very well done, Les. As he's climbing up the ladder, though, he drops that weapon. So now he's weaponless. He has nothing to protect himself. He gets into a cargo bay, it looks like, or something. There's like boxes and things stacked around. And then he steps onto a transporter pad on the side, beams himself over to the runabout at this point. And then he's in the runabout, which is where we started this episode.
That's right.
So now we see how he got there. Mm-hmm. We're starting to catch up to the beginning of the episode. He starts it up. Sisko calls him, says, shut down the engines. But Miles says he's already released the docking clamps. He's turned the tractor beams off. So he's out of here. They take a couple shots, but they don't get him. And this is where Susan Bay is going to show up. Because O'Brien calls Starfleet. He opens a subspace channel to Starbase 401, Priority 1 Admiral Rollman.
A.K.A. Mrs. Spock.
Yeah. Admiral Rollman appears, tells him to return to DS9. She seems very sincere here. So he's like, whatever's going on, it's not just DS9, it's all of Starfleet.
Yeah.
This is where, like paranoia can grow until you actually believe the craziest thing. It's like that's what's happening for him.
Conspiracy theory. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no reason to suspect this admiral, but he's taken all these steps of paranoia. Mm-hmm. So now it's not a big leap to go from what he believes to admirals and Starfleet and everyone's part of this.
Yeah.
Wow. Anyway, he hangs up on her. He thinks she's crazy too. He even says, it seems almost unbelievable to me. Had someone or something started to infiltrate all of Starfleet? So he's gone to the big conspiracy. Mm-hmm. He heads into the wormhole, and in the old days, that's where we would have a commercial, our very last commercial break. Mm-hmm. But on the streaming services, we don't. Keep going. So we're back to the present. I think he is ordering some more coffee, Jamaican blend, double strong, double sweet.
Jamaican blend.
He's had a lot of coffee. Is this the same coffee order that he made earlier, maybe?
Yeah.
It's always now we're the back. Same order, dude.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's
but I mean, is it literally
coffee.
Like in the timeline, have we come back, caught back up to that very first scene? Where
that's a possibility. Yeah, that's a possibility. Yeah.
Otherwise, he's drinking a lot. He's ordering a lot of coffee. I mean, how many cups can you drink on a runaway mission to the Parada system? One cup? Maybe two cups of coffee? Is that a two-cup trip?
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe they had turbulence and the first cup spilled. And
yes, it's a three-cup trip.
It's a three-cup. Yeah. Maybe it's...
Now,
maybe
with one of these, it's a one-cup trip.
Do not say the name. Do not say the
I
name.
I will not. Maybe Jamaican blend is like a little shot of espresso kind of size.
Yeah,
so maybe,
yeah, maybe
that's why he orders so many of them.
Well, that makes sense now.
Yeah.
Maybe. Okay. Anyway, he's almost to the Parada system at this point. Still ahead of the Mekong. He realizes once he drops out of warp, he's not going to have much time. He talks to the computer... find him a planet. He finds a planet. It's got seven moons. He does mention lucky seven, so I think Quark would appreciate that kind of, the gambling reference that he makes, lucky seven.
Why don't we have a river? Because we know all the runabouts are named after rivers. Why don't we have an American river represented? Why is it always other countries? Is there a reason? Do we have a USS Mississippi? Do we have a
Rio Grande?
Yeah, that's
Rio Grande. That's a North American continent. I get it, but
that
again,
goes through Rio Grande.
No,
through
Texas. That goes to the United States. Yeah.
Yeah. What else?
Yeah, but when you think of American rivers, you're not going to say Rio Grande first. You're going to say Mississippi, aren't you? The Mississippi
I'm gonna say the
River,
Chattahoochee. Because that's in Georgia.
You gonna go Chattahoochee? All right.
The Chattahoochee.
I'm trying to remember. I don't think there are. I don't think there
you
are.
You don't recall
anything. I wouldn't be the expert, but I don't think there are.
I like the Chattahoochee.
The Starfleet Chattahoochee.
Or maybe that's someone trying to say our charcuterie plate. They're like a Chattahoochee plate, please. You know. Okay.
Okay. Anyway, he drops to Impulse. Which now he was ahead by like 7 minutes or more.
Yes.
But as soon as he drops to Impulse, he's going to lose the time.
That's right.
So now he's down to like 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. He lets the Mekong catch him though, just as he's entering these magnetic fields.
Yep.
He's got to even go to manual navigation. I see him lean to one side. The camera Dutched. It was very nice.
Very nice.
Manual navigation. But it works. He loses them. And he asks the computer to track them. They're headed to Parada 2. He says, any transport signatures? Yes, they've beamed down. Their ship is empty now. So he heads to Parada 2 into synchronous orbit right over there.
And that didn't make sense to me. Mm. If he's trying to avoid them, why does he beam down to them?
Hmm.
Maybe he thinks he's following them secretly.
But he left the station. He's trying to get away from them. He's gone into the wormhole. He's trying to get away from them. He gets it. Why does he beam down to them? That didn't make any sense to me whatsoever.
He needed to spend a little more time switching gears after he lost them. Because he lost them behind this moon, the magnetic field, and then... Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe he should have had more of a log of, wait a minute, what are they doing? Are they going to meet some bad guys?
Yeah, I need to trail them.
Maybe it's now or never. I'm going to confront them. I'm going to see.
That sounds right.
Then that's it. But it's not in the script.
No.
And I went, why is he meeting them? You know, I want some explanation for that.
Mm-hmm. His logic completely shifted, but there was no script justification for it. No explanation. Well, he does beam down into our classic cave set, although it was painted kind of gray or white for this scene. They changed the color of the rocks. And
Mm-hmm. Soundstage 8.
Yes. He uses a tricorder to find his way to them, gets to a big door. There's a chamber door in the rock face, flings it open, goes inside the chamber. There's Kira and Sisko. He's got his weapon. Wait, how did he get his weapon, by the way? Didn't he drop that on the ladder?
He did. I guess one was stored in the ship, maybe.
In the shuttle, maybe. Yeah, or in the runabout. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, so doesn't this look like it's a secret hideout in a way, right?
Yeah,
so are these the rebels? Is this the Paradan rebel hideout? I don't know what the hell's going on.
I was happy with, because we don't know. It did look like the Parada rebels. It did.
Yeah.
But we don't know for sure. And that's good. Oh. I think that's good. That's good.
Okay. Okay.
I think, you know, again, they've got the skin that has the secretions that stink. I wish there had been something about the stinky people here. Maybe that's why they live in caves.
And what, forgive me, where was Michael Westmore on that makeup? Really, that looked like a plastic mask to me. I mean, Michael, you could do a lot better than that.
Oh, no.
Especially since that's the only alien. Well, there were some background aliens, but that's the only alien we're looking at. You give me a plastic mask? I don't know if it was plastic, but it looked like a plastic mask.
It didn't move. Like, the actor was not capable of any movement of it. So it just looked like a pullover.
It was glued here and that was it, you know?
Yeah.
I'm going to give Michael a pass. I'm going to say he was under the weather with the stomach flu and he could not approve anything better than that. So,
okay.
I'm going to say he designed a great makeup, but it was actually a practical stinky makeup, just like these aliens. And it was so stinky, he just couldn't spend much time near the makeup.
Yes.
So he just
said no.
He just thought, it's too stinky. I got to get away.
There isn't a lot of Dax in this episode. So he thought, well, if I don't
get to hang out with Terry.
I don't get Terry, then what's the point of being on the set?
What's the point of being on the set? I love it. Okay.
But he goes inside. He's got this gun, which I guess, Armin, you're right, probably got it on the runabout.
Yeah.
Demands that they drop their weapons. Sisko and Kira do. Kotu this alien, says that he'll understand everything. Miles will understand everything if he just looks behind this door. It'll all make sense. And Miles doesn't want to do it. Kotu makes a move, like to open the door or something.
Yeah.
And that distracts Miles. The other alien fires at him.
Yeah.
Knocks him down with their weapon. That's when the door opens.
This is the guy that jumped over the last Starfleet attack on the station.
Yeah, he did. He got rid of Sisko, Kira, Bashir, two security guys.
But a guy in a plastic mask, he can't avoid.
Exactly. He literally dodged a laser beam.
Stop it,
that's
guys.
How good he is. But the guy but with the...
Yeah, the guy with the plastic mask takes him down.
We're okay. Getting really close to the end now, guys. So we are.
All right, so the door opens. The door opens. There's Bashir.
Yeah.
Bashir's in there, and there's somebody in a chair with their back to us. Suddenly that person turns. It's O'Brien. It's another O'Brien.
Yeah. And at this point, you're still wondering, is that who's the real O'Brien? In
exactly.
A way?
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's the way it's
and I want to know how they did it. I understand the cuts. I understand that. But there is a shot where we get the side of O'Brien's head. And it sure looks like Cullum. Did they recreate his hair and made a wig so that they could do that? I want to know how they did it.
I think that was a double. I think it was a good double.
A really good double.
The shot you're talking about, because it was so complex. There were people behind the 50-50 or the 60-40 of the two O'Briens in the foreground. There was too much for them to do a green screen there. I don't think they would have done that.
Yeah.
So I think it was a double. They just featured more of the real Cullum, and then the double was kind of over the side.
Right. I'm really impressed by that. Really impressed by that.
Very well done. So the O'Brien we've been following this whole episode, we realize, is a replicant. And that the rebels had created this replicant to activate it during the peace talks. Maybe he was going to be an assassin. We don't really know. It feels very Manchurian Candidate here to me.
But also unsatisfying because we don't know what his mission was. We have no clue what it was. We're just surmising it was something, possibly an assassination.
Possibly an assassin. I love these moments of Cullum looking at himself. He played these really beautifully. Before we get to the last line, I do want to say, all right, this is where I was like, okay, if that was the circumstances, Sisko was told this guy on the ship is a replicant, possibly an assassin.
No. Forgive me. They don't know which is which. And so everyone on the ship, that's why they played it as casually as they have, because they don't know if it's the real O'Brien or the replicant O'Brien.
Right.
Okay.
So Sisko has been told that there's a replicant. Yes, absolutely. But no one knows for sure. That's what the physical was all about. No one knows for sure which is which.
Right.
Okay.
But even so let's say they had one on Parada and one on the ship. Why not just put them both in the brig and do the tests and figure it out? Why risk letting a potential replicant assassin, God knows what skills this replicant has. Why let him wander around with your son, Jake, or every, like, it just,
right.
Once I got to this, I was like, that would have been like, why put everybody at risk?
Mm-hmm.
Just throw him in the brig.
Is it possible they only captured, well, that they only found the real O'Brien at the last moment?
That makes more sense.
That's why they've gone to this cave.
Yes. That makes more sense.
I guess, but even if they hadn't only found this one on the ship, throw him in the brig and say, hey, we think you're Miles O'Brien, but we're not sure. So we're going to keep you here. We're going to need to run some tests. We're going to have to find this other one.
But they have run tests, you see.
The physical.
They have run the physical. He's encountered all these people that he knows, and no one can tell the difference. No one. Keiko can't tell the difference. No one can tell the difference.
Yeah.
So you think that when we see other real O'Brien in the cave, when the cave door opens up, he's also being tested to see if he is the real O'Brien?
I think that's why Bashir's in there. I think that's why Bashir's in there.
Okay.
But I still think it's reckless not to lock him down.
Right.
Even if because, you've only got one.
Yeah.
They tried to lock him down, but they've tried to arrest him in Odo's office. They tried. He got away.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. That was my only hole in this. Once I found out the ending, I was like, boy, that seemed reckless to me that they just let a potential assassin run around.
Yeah. And then there's the question of why he came back. Even Kotu asked that. So I wonder why he came back. And O'Brien's like, well, if it was me, I would be trying to warn somebody that there was something wrong, you know. And it's just, I don't know. It's so many more questions.
It's a very sweet sentiment because it's basically suggesting that this replicant at its essence is still the hero that Miles O'Brien is, even though it's not the real Miles.
Right.
It's got the same, as hard as they want to make him an assassin, he's still going to be Miles.
Yeah. And they give him to that end, they give him a wonderful last line. The replicant gets a wonderful last line.
Yeah. About Keiko telling her that he loves her. Yeah, that's good.
Tell Keiko I love her. Mm. Yeah, he was a hero. Oh, very sweet.
Okay.
Very sweet. Stick around. There's lots more after this message from our sponsor.
What's your lesson, Robbie McNeil, from this overall?
My lesson, episode? I wrote down, a person's true character will always come through. Even though this replicant was meant to be a bad guy, Miles's true character was always part of him. It always showed him
through. Okay. Armin, do you have a lesson?
I have two. I found it very difficult to find a moral in this episode, a real difficulty. So I eventually went to my computer and inputted several words that I thought were themes for the show, and I came up with two different themes. One is a moral from Joseph Campbell, which I don't think works as well. And Joseph Campbell wrote, opportunities to find deeper powers within ourselves come when life seems most challenging. I'm not sure I like that. The other one was from an older philosopher, Ovid, who said, first appearances deceive many.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. Yeah. But it was very difficult for me to find a moral in this episode. It was, for me, film noir.
Yeah.
And the point of the episode is to keep us guessing.
Yeah.
So that we're not really learning anything. We're just trying to solve the riddle.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, I had the same feeling with most of the episode. It wasn't until that final reveal that I thought, all right, well, what were they trying to say with this reveal? Like, what are they trying to say about... That's where I had to grasp from, because the 99% of the episode is a psychological thriller or film noir kind of thing. Garrett, what's your wise, insightful theme?
The only thing I could come up with was, if your spouse is, if the assumption is that your spouse is an evil replicant,
yes,
close your eyes while you're kissing him so you don't throw him off the trail. So you throw him off that. Yeah, you know what I'm saying.
Yes. Basically, cover more.
Try to act like you're really his wife. Close your darn eyes while you're kissing your husband, okay? That's all.
I think that's excellent. Excellent.
Thank you for that.
I think
deep
of the three of us, you have hit the nail on the head.
Yes. You're welcome. Well, our Patreon poll for lesson, theme, or moral of this episode, submitted by Jenny, is, if you have problems with literally everyone, consider that you're the common denominator.
I like
that's
that
good.
One.
That's
that
good.
That was really good.
There you go.
It's very good.
That could hold true for I think all three of us know people in our lives that need to take this advice.
And that applies to my character as well.
Yes. If you
Oh my gosh. All right. Well, we've come to the end of our recap and discussion of the episode Whispers. Thank you to all of you who have tuned in for that. And for all of our Patreon patrons, please stay tuned for your bonus material. For everyone else, we will see you next time when we review, recap the episode Paradise with, once again, the beloved Armin Shimerman that we love so much.
The small business genius,
not the diminutive small business genius.
Exactly.
Okay. All right.
Thanks, everybody.
See you next time.